Voice of America.
Good morning. Today is Monday, July 20th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump will not commit to accepting the results of the U.S. presidential election in November.
You don't know until you see. It depends. I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
And the latest in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's corruption trial. Plus, U.S. civil rights icon John Lewis passes away at 80 years old. These stories and more are next. Our top story today. U.S. President Donald Trump condemned protests in Portland, Oregon Sunday as his Republican administration prepared to intervene in urban centers that he says have lost control of anti-racism demonstrations. Demonstrators protesting against racism and police brutality have gathered daily near the federal courthouse in Portland since the killing of African-American George Floyd in police custody in May, with crowds at times exceeding 10,000. The protests have mainly been against local police who have been patrolling the demonstrations and are themselves accused of brutality against the protesters. But last week, federal law enforcement officers, armed with a new executive order aimed at protecting U.S. monuments, started cracking down on the crowds in Portland. In recent days, videos have surfaced showing camouflaged officers without clear identification badges using force and unmarked vehicles to arrest protesters without explanation, sparking nationwide outrage. Some of the federal officers in Portland have since been identified as members of the Department of Homeland Security's Customs and Border Protection Unit. Local elected officials have called for the federal forces to leave, and lawsuits have been filed against them. But the Department of Homeland Security's acting chief Chad Wolf defended their actions, saying, quote, "Our men and women in uniform are patriots. We will never surrender to violent extremists on my watch," end quote. On Sunday, President Trump also did not back down. On Twitter, he said, quote, "We are trying to help Portland, not hurt it. Their leadership has, for months, lost control of the anarchists and agitators. They are missing in action. We must protect federal property and our people," end quote. For more on what's happening on the ground, I spoke with Alex Zielinski, news editor of the Portland Mercury newspaper in Portland, Oregon.
In the beginning of July, the number of federal officers kind of grew after Donald Trump deployed a number of really highly trained Border Patrol agents, highly trained but not entirely trained in riot control, the agents to Portland to defend federal buildings, which what we've seen means, you know, indiscriminately using tear gas on crowds of people without any warning after really small provocation. What has become very shocking is how quickly federal officers have shot tear gas canisters and impact munitions into the crowd. One case in particular that occurred last weekend, a protester named Donovan Labella was holding a boombox above his head, just kind of standing still as federal officers came out and started shooting tear gas at folks. One of them shot him in the head, in the face, with a so-called less lethal munition. And he's in the hospital with facial reconstruction surgery because of that.
Now, one thing that has really ignited outrage around the country are these videos showing camouflaged, unmarked officers just snatching people off the street, throwing them into vans, driving them away. What do we know about these incidents?
These incidents are really hard to track and to collect any information on. I mean, some reporters were able to speak to a victim, I'd say, of this kind of arbitrary snatching of people off the street. The person that was featured in this story, if they were even, you know, there was no probable cause for a crime. The Department of Homeland Security, who oversees these officers, says that this arrest didn't even happen. They're kind of denying a lot of it, which is frightening. According to the people who have experienced these detentions from federal police, they have a hard time trying to even figure out why they were arrested or were detained. They don't seem to be the normal kind of rabble-rousers. It's really hard to tell, and it's difficult because the federal government and their law enforcement agencies are such a black box, and it's so hard to get any information from them. And I think the fear around this is tangible just even on the ground during these demonstrations. Now people are really afraid to kind of go down side streets by themselves or, you know, leave protests on their own without someone else with them.
And what are the reasons that the Department of Homeland Security has given for these arrests?
I mean, the reasons that we've gotten from DHS have been kind of vague allegations that these people that have been plucked up the street were part of a riot, were part of an angry mob of people who were protesting. I think it's really important to point out that that is the way that local police and officials have also, in some points, talked about these demonstrations, really talking about the entire crowd as people who are engaged in a riot when that is a criminal act that few people might be engaging in, or, you know, one person throwing rocks at, you know, that police or starting fires. Law enforcement, including federal officers, are seeing it as almost everyone who was there in that protest is committing that crime. And so they're responding in that way.
Now, what have the protesters actually been doing to this federal building that the federal officers are saying they're there to protect?
So there's been a ton of graffiti kind of as far up as, you know, a human can reach on the walls of this building. There's been windows broken. Several people have brought a lot of commercial grade fireworks to these demonstrations and shot them not at the building, but just kind of like right in the entryway. Right now, what we're seeing is this federal building has made kind of its it's built up some like kind of wooden structure over the front entrance, like an additional door for officers to go in and out. And protesters are trying to kind of barricade and block those doors with some remains of fencing that was up earlier, which, you know, I think can be viewed as frightening. But there's also other exits and entrances to this very large building. I'd say along with that, yeah, people throwing rocks and, you know, frozen water bottles and certainly nothing lethal, different ways that I think put these officers on edge, but they've been responding with very disproportionate amounts of force.
Now, has the deployment of federal officers succeeded in reducing or quelling the protests in Portland?
There is a kind of reinvigoration, I'd say, in the protests. They were dwindling down a bit. The numbers were diminishing. I think people were just getting kind of exhausted and not really sure where it was going. And now that there is a new focus of kind of anger and frustration against federal officers. Last night, there were probably 2,000 folks out protesting, and the night before as well. And so we're seeing kind of this second wave of a movement here. Multiple times when I'm out after, you know, there's a lot of tear gas shot into the crowd, or there's a lot of munitions, there's kind of these, they happen in these like really brief moments where it's just a ton of volleys of these canisters being thrown into huge crowds of, you know, hundreds. And after that, you see people, you know, who have just washed out their eyes from tear gas, who are just like kind of in shock, just really yelling and like really upset and yelling at the officers who are dressed, you know, in really military outfits, trying to like understand why they're there, what they're doing there, and just expressing their fear and rage.
And what do you think is next?
I don't see a lot of protesters stopping until the federal officers are gone. I also see, you know, there's still a dedication to continuing these protests against local police. The ability to sustain this movement is remarkable. But at the same time, the ability for law enforcement to also kind of continue showing up and continue being there is, you know, equally strong. I don't see the DHS stepping down anytime soon. It seems like they have taken the rejection and refusal of their presence in Oregon as almost a challenge.
Over the weekend, top Democratic leaders in the U.S. said they were alarmed by the Trump administration's tactics against protesters in Portland and called on federal inspectors general to investigate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the actions amounted to, quote, kidnapping, end quote. She continued, quote, while Portland is the president's current target, Any city could be next. We live in a democracy, not a banana republic, end quote. For more on the implications of deploying federal officers to quell protests, I spoke to Dr. Risa Brooks, an associate professor of political science at Marquette University in Wisconsin and an expert on American and comparative civil-military relations.
There was an effort by the Trump administration to get the regular U.S. military to come onto the street in Washington, D.C. and help assist law enforcement there in policing George Floyd protesters. And the military pushed back on that and basically said, no, we're not up for that. In late June, we get an executive order from the president sort of mandating or allowing federal forces to assist in protecting monuments, et cetera. And that's broadly defined, especially by Department of Homeland Security, DHS, to allow them to participate in sort of addressing civil disturbances more broadly. Now, it's supposed to be to protect sort of federal property, but that there's a lot of give in there, and we're seeing that play out in Portland. And so what's happened is it's not the regular military, but it's these other forces under DHS, and not just any forces under them, but the crack forces. They're getting like heavily militarized, heavily trained subunits that are usually deployed for really serious like drug smuggling operations or really intense things, not against regular people in the streets who are unarmed. So those are the forces that are involved. And basically it's in part because the Trump administration probably couldn't get the regular military or even the National Guard to do some of these things.
Now, looking at these federal officers more specifically, they come from the Customs and Border Protection Unit. Who are they and what do they normally do?
Usually they operate at the border and they are in charge of apprehending people who are trying to get into the U.S. illegally. And they can do that in quite a militarized fashion. They are not usually sent out just to police protests and in these sort of gray area kind of enforcement operation. It's a dynamic where it's legal what's happening, but it's not consistent with the spirit and the intent of what these forces are usually supposed to be used for. It's bending the rules, using democratic processes, using legal means to enforce sort of an abuse of power.
Now, what's the Trump administration trying to accomplish with this?
Just in general, it's a pretty useful distraction from the catastrophe of the pandemic in the United States and how poorly that's been managed and how awful it is right now with so many deaths and so many cases. But I think that there's also a deeper story. It's signaling that he's a law and order president, that he's tough, and that he has, you know, the coercive sector on his side, that they don't answer to the American people. They're really his political ally. What's important there is it really doesn't matter exactly how extensive this gets. The signal has been sent.
You've researched civil-military relations around the world. What usually happens when a chief executive tries to do something like this?
One of the things that really matters are the checks and balances, the pushback. In a democratic state, you should see courts, you should see public opinion, you should see the legislative branch, Congress, pushing back and saying, look, whether or not these are sort of legal, this is not how we intended these forces to be used, this is not appropriate. If that fails, you see the growth of large internal security apparatuses. These are entities that monitor the population. They arrest people, sometimes for no reason. They disappear people. It's basically a way of keeping the population compliant with the ruler. And it can be quite horrific and brutal to the population and quite effective at repressing and keeping opposition down.
Now, you're not saying that's what's happening here.
I'm certainly not saying that. What I'm saying, hopefully, and we're already seeing hopeful signs of this, there's political and legal pushback to the misuse of these forces. And that's a positive sign. The point really is, though, the logical extension, where this ends, if there aren't those pushbacks, are in the growth of these kinds of extrajudicial groups, paramilitaries that are allied with an executive, chief executive, a president, or otherwise, that is used to enforce the rule of that leader. That's why so many people find it so alarming. This isn't supposed to happen in a democratic state, to even be thinking about these questions. And yet, here we are.
That was Dr. Risa Brooks, an associate professor of political science at Marquette University in Wisconsin and an expert on American and comparative civil-military relations. As protests continue and as the coronavirus outbreak worsens in the U.S., President Trump has seen his popularity erode, while support builds for his rival, presumed Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. But President Trump, in an interview aired Sunday by Fox News, said he would not commit to accepting the results of the upcoming presidential election in November.
You don't know until you see. It depends. I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
Fox journalist Chris Wallace pressed Trump for an answer.
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. Look, I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no, and I didn't last time either.
Biden responded to Trump's comments saying, quote, "The American people will decide this election, and the United States government is perfectly capable of escorting trespassers out of the White House," end quote. In 2016, Trump also refused to say whether he would accept election results. At that time, opinion polls showed he was far behind Democrat candidate Hillary Clinton. Trump contends that a series of polls that today show him losing popularity compared to Biden are faulty. He believes Republican voters are underrepresented in such surveys.
First of all, I'm not losing because those are fake polls. They were fake in 2016, and now they're even more fake. The polls were much worse in 2016.
For more on Trump's refusal to commit to accepting election results, I spoke with constitutional law professor Joel Richard Paul from the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco.
This is another example of the president not following the norms of his office. But the fact is that the president doesn't have to accept the results. The Constitution doesn't particularly care if the loser accepts the results or not. Results are determined by the Electoral College, and so long as the Electoral College votes, that will determine who the next president will be.
So if Trump does reject the Electoral College results, what can he do?
Yeah, well, I think that if the president believed that there were false ballots counted, or if he thought that the ballots had not been counted appropriately, he can certainly ask for a state recount. That's what happened in 2000 when Vice President Gore asked for a recount in the state of Florida. And the states are prepared to conduct those kinds of recounts. The president's objection seems to be that he thinks that voting by mail is fraudulent. And that's simply not true. The president himself votes by mail. The military for decades has voted by mail, and voting by mail generally is considered by most election experts to be safer than voting in person because you have tracking numbers, you have to sign your ballot, your signature can be checked against the signature on record. And so voting by mail actually creates a paper trail, which makes it easier to conduct a recount. Those are the only remedies that would be available to the president if he objected to the result. Now, I suppose there's always the possibility that the president could simply decide that he's not going to leave office and try by force of arms to stay in power. But our military is sworn to uphold the Constitution, and I'm pretty confident that the culture of the military is such that they would do so. There is also the risk, of course, the president has developed what looks increasingly like a kind of personal guard in the Department of Justice and in the Department of Homeland Security. And I suppose he could try to rally those people. Ultimately, what will really happen here is that if the president tried some unconstitutional attempt to seize power, to maintain power, it would be up to the Congress of the United States to act. And I guess then it really depends on whether the Republicans maintain their majority in the Senate or not. I guess there's always the risk that the Republicans, if they had the majority in the Senate, could choose not to act to remove the president. Unfortunately, there have been relatively few Republicans who have been willing to speak out when the president has acted in a way that's not consistent with the norms of his office. But assuming they don't hold a majority in the Senate, and I would imagine if the Democrats were in charge of both houses, that the president would not really have any leg to stand on.
Now, Trump's comments come as he's falling behind in the polls. He's called them fake polls. What do you make of these polls?
Well, first of all, I think that we should all remember that the polls 4 years ago showed that Hillary Clinton was going to win in a walk. So I don't think anyone should take a great deal of comfort or worry too much about what the polls are saying now. It's still 100 days to the election, and that's really a lifetime in politics. But I guess if you're President Trump and you don't like to lose, one way to avoid losing would be to step aside and to decide not to seek re-election and allow his vice president to run instead, which has happened in the past and could happen again.
That was constitutional law professor Joel Richard Paul from the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. A United Arab Emirates spacecraft began its journey to Mars with a blastoff in Japan on Monday in what is the Arab world's first interplanetary mission. The launch of the spacecraft, named Amal or Hope, marks the start of a seven-month journey to the Red Planet. The probe will study the upper atmosphere and monitor climate change while circling Mars for at least 2 years. The craft is expected to reach Mars in February 2021. A fire in the 15th century cathedral in the western French city of Nantes blew out stained glass windows and destroyed the grand organ on Saturday, and officials said they suspected arson. Prosecutor Pierre Senet told reporters three fires had been started at the site, and authorities were treating the incident as a criminal act. Officials said an investigation has been opened. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The locked-down Australian city of Melbourne is facing even tougher restrictions amid a surge in coronavirus cases. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The new outbreak in Melbourne, a city of 5 million people, has derailed Australia's earlier success in tackling the virus. Hundreds of infections are being reported each day. There were 428 Friday, a daily record since the pandemic began, and 217 Saturday. Most cases have been detected within areas under lockdown, including clusters at schools and care homes for the aged. Victoria State's Chief Health Officer is Professor Brett Sutton.
Tragically, there'll be several who'll require intensive care support and a number of people will die. It does reflect behaviours and mobility from 10 or more days ago. And so, of course, there's a hope that these numbers stabilise in the coming days.
If that doesn't happen, Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews says even tougher lockdown measures could be brought in.
If the data shows that the strategy is not being as effective as quickly as we would like, then we may have to go to new rules. The rules are to protect you. The rules are to serve all of us.
The new wave of infections is blamed on security breaches in the hotel quarantine system for travellers returning to Australia, and large family gatherings where distancing and hygiene protocols were ignored. Hundreds of cases have been detected at apartment blocks in the poorest parts of Melbourne, where some residents complain they've been treated like criminals. As the crisis continues, travel between Victoria and other parts of Australia is being heavily restricted and strict border controls put in place. The next session of federal parliament is likely to be cancelled because of the pandemic. Lawmakers were scheduled to return to Canberra in August. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's corruption trial will begin hearing witness testimony in January, the court in Israel announced Sunday. The decision comes amid growing protests over Netanyahu's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, including violence and calls for Netanyahu to resign. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
A judge in Jerusalem ruled that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's trial on three counts of corruption, fraud, and breach of trust will begin to hear testimony from witnesses in January, and that hearings will be held three times a week. Netanyahu was not present. His defense attorney had asked for a delay because of the COVID-19 pandemic, arguing it will be hard for him to question witnesses who are wearing face masks. Israeli analysts say Netanyahu has consistently tried to delay his trial and has asked the court to allow him to accept donations from wealthy friends and relatives for his defense, a request the court has denied. Netanyahu is accused in three different cases, including Case 4000, which is seen as the most serious. In that case, he is accused of approving regulatory moves that would benefit the main shareholder of Israel's largest telecom company in exchange for positive news coverage. Israel's justice minister says the trial will continue even if Israel imposes a full lockdown to fight the pandemic. The trial comes as the Israeli public has lost faith in the government in general and in Netanyahu in particular, according to Tamar Herman, a pollster at the Israel Democracy Institute.
So what we see is a general sharp decline in trust in all people and teams involved in the policymaking regarding the corona crisis.
Herman said Netanyahu's approval rating has gone from 60% in March, even during the first wave of the pandemic, to less than 30%. Frustration over the handling of the second wave is also breeding growing anger at the government, especially among younger Israelis. For the second week in a row, more than 10,000 Israelis demonstrated in both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, most wearing masks. But after the demonstration ended, a few dozen blocked roads and clashed with police, leading to arrests. The unemployment rate in Israel is skyrocketing, and many say they have not yet received promised government aid. COVID-19 has now left 400 dead since the beginning of the pandemic, and a growing number of others with serious damage to their health. The government this weekend decided to close all gyms, pools, and restaurants except for takeout and delivery. Beaches and malls will be closed on weekends, but not during the week. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Longtime U.S. Congressman John Lewis, a champion of civil rights for African Americans, has died after a year-long battle with pancreatic cancer. Lewis was 80 years old. VOA's Chris Simpkins has more on the life of an extraordinary man.
We cannot give up now. We cannot give in.
A leader of the modern-day American civil rights movement, John Lewis worked closely with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and was the last surviving keynote speaker from the 1963 March on Washington.
We shall splinter the segregated South into a thousand pieces and put them together in the image of God and democracy. We must say, wake up, America, wake up!
Lewis gained national recognition 2 years later when he, along with other voting rights demonstrators, were beaten by police in Selma, Alabama. The 1965 incident known as Bloody Sunday triggered a national awakening to end racial discrimination.
We were beaten, we were tear gassed. I thought I was going to die on this bridge.
Months after the violence, Lewis stood next to President Lyndon Johnson when the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act was signed into law. It was a crowning moment for Lewis as the legislation outlawed discriminatory voting practices that kept African Americans from gaining political power.
The Act of 1965 freed and liberated so many people.
In 1986, Lewis began his own political career after being elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Georgia. Called the conscience of the Congress, Lewis fought against income inequality and for criminal justice reform and gun safety.
We cannot continue to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the reality of mass gun violence in our nation.
In 2011, President Barack Obama awarded Lewis the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Right before New Year's Day, 2020, the veteran congressman announced he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. While under cancer treatment, he returned to his native Alabama to commemorate the 55th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday March, refusing to let his grave condition hold him back.
I'm not going to give up. No. I'm not going to give in.
No.
I'm going to continue to fight. We need your prayers now more than ever before. Let's do it. We can do it. A different place.
Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Zingani, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
In a little